Hello and welcome to the reading of the Associated Press. My name is Donna Frano and today is Wednesday, February 18th, 2026. We will start with international news. This article is entitled, Iran says it temporarily closed the Strait of Hormuz as it held more indirect talks with the United States. This has been written by Jamie Keaton and Stephanie Lichtenstein. Iran announced the temporary closure of the Strait of Hormuz on Tuesday for live fire drills and a rare show of force as its negotiators held another round of indirect talks with the United States over the Islamic Republic's disputed nuclear program. It was the first time Iran has announced the closure of the key international waterway through which 20% of the world's oil passes since the United States began threatening Iran and rushing military assets to the region. It was not immediately clear if the strait had been closed, but such a rare and perhaps unprecedented move could further escalate tensions that threaten to ignite another war in the Middle East. As the talks began, Iran's state media announced that Iranian forces had fired live missiles toward the strait and would close it for several hours for safety and maritime concerns. Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, meanwhile, warned that the strongest army in the world might sometimes receive such a slap that it cannot get back on its feet. Iran's foreign minister later adopted a different tone, expressing optimism about the talks and saying a new window has opened for reaching an agreement. We are hopeful that negotiations will lead to a sustainable and negotiated solution which can serve the interests of relevant parties and the broader region. Abbas Araghchi told a United Nations disarmament conference after leading the Iranian delegation at the talks held in Geneva. He added that Iran remains fully prepared to defend itself against any threat or act of aggression, and that the consequences of any attack on Iran would not be confined to its borders. He made no specific mention of the military drills or the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. United States President Donald Trump, who scrapped an earlier nuclear agreement with Iran during his first term, has repeatedly threatened to use force to compel Iran to agree to constrain its nuclear program. Iran has said it would respond with an attack of its own. Trump has also threatened Iran over the killing of protesters. Trump's envoys, Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, led the U.S. delegation at the latest indirect talks held inside the residence of the Omani envoy to Geneva. Oman, a longtime regional mediator, had hosted an earlier round on February 6th. There was progress in the talks, but many details remain to be discussed, according to a U.S. official who was not authorized to comment publicly and spoke on condition of anonymity. The Iranian delegation said they would present more detailed proposals in the next 2 weeks to narrow gaps, the official said. In some ways, it went well, U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance said in an interview with Fox News Channel after he spoke with Witkoff and Kushner. But in other ways, it was very clear that the president has set some red lines that the Iranians are not yet willing to actually acknowledge and work through. The United States also hosted talks between envoys from Russia and Ukraine in Geneva on Tuesday and Wednesday, days ahead of the fourth anniversary of the all-out Russian invasion of its neighbor. Araghchi, who led the Iranian side, also said he met with Director General Rafael Grossi of the International Atomic Energy Agency on Monday in Geneva. The Iranian minister said they discussed the agency's role in helping to achieve an agreement. Iran said its Revolutionary Guard started a drill early Monday in the Strait of Hormuz, the Persian Gulf, and the Gulf of Oman, which are crucial international shipping routes. It was the second time in recent weeks that Iran has held a live fire drill in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran often carries out military drills in the strait that can impede maritime traffic, but the announced closure went a step further. Danny Citrinowicz, an Iran expert at Israel's Institute for National Security Studies, said Iran last closed the strait during the war with Iraq in the 1980s when it mined the waterway. He said the latest announcement was a message to the international community that any strike on Iran would have global impact. Oil prices fell after the talks concluded. U.S. oil was down 1.3% at $62.06 per barrel, while international benchmark Brent crude was off fully 2.3% at $67.03 per barrel. Oil prices had risen several dollars per barrel after Trump began bolstering the United States military presence in the Middle East, but remained subdued on expectation that the eventual deal would seal or would send prices lower. Khamenei, meanwhile, stepped up his warnings to the United States over its military buildup. Of course, a warship is a dangerous apparatus, but more dangerous than the warship is the weapon that can sink the warship, Khamenei said, according to Iranian state TV. He also warned the United States against forcing the result of talks in advance. Last week, Trump said the USS Gerald R. Ford, the world's largest aircraft carrier, was being sent to the Mideast. It will join the USS Abraham Lincoln and its accompanying guided missile destroyers, which have been in the region for 3 weeks. The USS Gerald R. Ford and its escort of three destroyers are now in the mid-Atlantic after being ordered to depart the Caribbean for the Middle East last week, a Navy official confirmed Tuesday. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive ship movements, said the Ford, along with the destroyers USS Mahan, Bainbridge, and Winston Churchill, are in the mid-Atlantic and no longer with the USS Southern Command's area of operations. Given its current location, the Ford and its escorts are likely more than a week away from reaching the waters off the coast of Iran. U.S. forces shot down an Iranian drone that approached the Lincoln on the same day last week that Iran tried to stop a U.S. flagged ship in the Strait of Hormuz. Gulf Arab nations have warned any attack could spiral into another regional conflict in a Mideast still reeling from the Israel-Hamas war. The Trump administration is seeking a deal to limit Iran's nuclear program and ensure it does not develop nuclear weapons. Iran says it is not pursuing weapons and has so far resisted demands that it halt uranium enrichment on its soil or hand over its stockpiles of highly enriched uranium. The United States and Iran were in the middle of months of meetings when Israel's launch of a 12-day war against Iran back in June halted the talks. The U.S. bombed Iranian nuclear sites during that war, likely destroying many of the centrifuges that spun uranium to near weapons-grade purity. Israel's attacks decimated Iran's air defenses and targeted its ballistic missile arsenal as well. Before the June war, Iran had been enriching uranium up to 60% purity, a short technical step away from weapons-grade levels. Our next article continues on with the story entitled, What to Know About the Strait of Hormuz, which Iran says it temporarily closed for military drill. This has been written by John Gambrell. Iran says it temporarily closed parts of the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow mouth of the Persian Gulf. The move came as semi-official Iranian news agencies reported live fire exercises in the vital waterway, through which 20% of the world's oil passes. The move is a rare, perhaps unprecedented, shutdown of the strait, a signal from Iran of the potential fallout to the world economy if the United States goes through with threats to attack it as tensions mount between the two countries. In past times of tension and conflict, Iran has at times harassed shipping through the narrows, and during the 1980s Iran-Iraq war, both sides attacked tankers and other vessels using naval mines to completely shut down traffic at points. But Iran has not carried out repeated threats to close the waterway altogether since the 1980s, even during last year's 12-day war when Israel and the United States bombarded Iran's key nuclear and military sites. The extent and impact of Tuesday's closure were not immediately known. Iranian media said it would be for several hours for safety and maritime concerns. The United States' military central command did not immediately comment on the closure or Iran's live fire drills. But during Iranian military exercises in the Strait and nearby waters several weeks ago, it warned Tehran that any unsafe and unprofessional behavior near U.S. forces, regional partners, or commercial vessels increases risks of collision, escalation, and destabilization. Here's what you know about the Strait, the drill, what caused the tensions, and what might happen next. The Strait of Hormuz is a bending waterway, about 21 miles wide at its narrowest point. It connects the Persian Gulf to the Gulf of Oman. From there, ships can then travel to the rest of the world. While Iran and Oman have their territorial waters in the Strait, it's viewed as an international waterway all ships can ply. The United Arab Emirates, home to the skyscraper-studded city of Dubai, also sits near the waterway. The Strait of Hormuz through history has been important for trade with ceramics, ivory, silk, and textiles moving from China through the region. In the modern era, it is the route for supertankers carrying oil and gas from Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Qatar, Bahrain, the UAE, and Iran. The vast majority of it goes to markets in Asia, including Iran's only remaining oil customer, China. Well, there are pipelines in Saudi Arabia and the UAE that can avoid the passage. The U.S. Energy Information Administration says most volumes that transit the Strait have no alternative means of exiting the region. Threats to the route have spiked global energy prices in the past, including during the Israel-Iran war in June. With the United States threatening to strike amid the massive nationwide anti-government protest that erupted in late December and January, Iran held a live-fire military drill in the Strait of Hormuz in early February. It warned ships of the drill at the time but did not close the passage. On February 4th, tensions between the Iranian and U.S. navies rose further after a U.S. Navy fighter jet shot down an Iranian drone that was approaching the aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, in the Arabian Sea. Iran also harassed a U.S.-flagged and U.S.-crewed merchant vessel that was sailing in the Strait of Hormuz, the U.S. military reported. On Monday, Iran announced its new drill, dubbed Smart Control of the Strait of Hormuz Military Drill. Mariners in the region were warned by radio that it planned live surface firing. The semi-official Tasman news agency, which is close to the country's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard, reported a live missile test Tuesday morning, saying missiles launched from inside Iran and along its coast had struck their targets in the Strait of Hormuz. U.S. CENTCOM has previously said Iran has a right to operate professionally in international airspace and waters, but it warned against interfering or threatening American warships or passing commercial vessels. The command, which oversees the U.S. Navy's Bahrain-based Fifth Fleet, said it would not tolerate actions such as Iranian aircraft or vessels getting too close to American warships or pointing weapons toward them. The actions around the Strait come amid increasing tension between the United States and Iran. U.S. President Donald Trump initially threatened to launch a military strike against Iran after its bloody crackdown on last month's protests. Since then, he has shifted to threatening attack to pressure Tehran to make a deal over its nuclear program. The two sides held a new round of indirect nuclear negotiations in Geneva on Tuesday. The USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier and supporting guided missile destroyers have been in the Arabian Sea for several weeks, where they could launch an attack if Trump calls for it. Trump said Friday the USS Gerald R. Ford, the world's largest aircraft carrier, was being sent from the Caribbean to the Mideast to join other military assets the U.S. has built up in the region. Iran has warned it could launch its own preemptive strike or target American interest across the Middle East and Israel. While the 12-day war saw Iran fire off ballistic missiles and Israel target its stockpile, Tehran maintains an arsenal of short and medium-range missiles that could hit surrounding Gulf Arab states. On Tuesday, Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei warned the U.S. that the strongest army in the world might sometimes receive such a slap that it cannot get back on its feet. Of course, a warship is a dangerous apparatus, but more dangerous than the warship is the weapon that can sink the warship into the depths of the sea, Khamenei said, Iranian state TV reported. Our next article is entitled, Former Army Chief Seen as Zelensky's Top Rival Reveals to AP a Rift Between Them. This has been written by Samia Kulab and Susie Blan. Ever since he was ousted as the head of Ukraine's army in 2024 and appointed as the country's ambassador to Britain, Valery Zelensky has widely been seen as the top political rival to President Volodymyr Zelensky. Zelensky, 52, refuses to discuss his political ambitions, saying he doesn't want to risk harming national unity during a war with Russia that is approaching its fourth anniversary. Yet, in a sign of his possible desire to run for the presidency after the war is over, Zelensky spoke publicly for the first time about a deep rift between himself and Zelensky in a recent interview with the Associated Press. Tensions emerged soon after Russia's full-scale invasion in February of 2022, and tempers often flared between the two men over how best to defend the country, Zelensky said. The strained relationship reached a boiling point later that year when dozens of agents from Ukraine's domestic intelligence service raided Zelensky's office, he told the AP. Zelensky alleges that the previously unreported incident was an act of intimidation. It risked exposing their rivalry at a time when national unity was paramount. Zelensky's office and Ukraine's security service, known as the SBU, declined to comment for this story. The AP could not independently confirm Zelensky's account of the raid. Even years later, the revelation threatens to polarize public opinion in Ukraine at a critical moment in the war. Russian forces are making slow, steady gains across Ukraine's eastern front, and both sides are clinging to incompatible demands as the U.S. presses them to reach a deal. Zelensky said that during the 2022 raid on his office, he called Zelensky's chief of staff, warning him he was prepared to call in the military to stop it and protect the command center. I will fight with you and have already called in reinforcements to the center of Kiev for support. While that near crisis early in the war passed, disagreements between Zelensky and Zelensky over how to defend their country persisted, according to Zelensky, who said he often challenged the president's military strategy. A dispute over a counteroffensive in 2023 that ultimately failed was a particularly contentious, the former general said. Although Zelensky's popularity with the public had been cemented by several successes on the battlefield, Zelensky dismissed him as army chief in February of 2024 and later announced he would be headed to London. The move was widely seen by political analysts as an effort by Zelensky to limit Zelensky's potential as a political rival by distancing him from day-to-day affairs in Ukraine. Polls consistently gave Zelensky a slight lead over Zelensky in a hypothetical race. Zelensky's once robust popularity has waned as the war drags on. A corruption scandal implicating several of Zelensky's top officials has eroded public trust, according to lawmakers and activists. Zelensky recently reshuffled his leadership team in an effort to restore confidence. The United States has been ramping up pressure on Russia and Ukraine to end the war. While a deal remains elusive, Zelensky has agreed in principle to a plan laid out by U.S. President Donald Trump that calls for elections once the war is over and security guarantees are in place. One evening in mid-September of 2022, as Ukraine was mounting an effective counteroffensive in the northeast, Zelensky, then army commander, emerged from a tense meeting at Zelensky's headquarters and headed back to his office in Kiev. Hours later, dozens of agents from Ukraine's security service showed up at Zelensky's office to search the premises, Zelensky said. Over a dozen British officers were there at the time, he said. The Ukrainian agents did not say what they were looking for, according to Zelensky, who says he prevented them from rifling through documents and computers. The raid was clearly a threat, Zelensky said, and the presence of the agents he phoned Zelensky's chief of staff at the time, Andrei Yermak, and made a stark warning. I told Yermak that I would repel this attack because I know how to fight. Zeluzhny then phoned the head of the security service at the time, Vasily Malik, to ask what was happening. Malik said he knew nothing about the raid and promised to look into it, according to Zeluzhny. Later, he learned that Malik's agency had sought a search warrant from a district court in Kiev 2 days earlier to inspect that same address. The agency was seeking to search a strip club allegedly run by a criminal organization, according to a court document obtained by the AP. But the strip club named in the filing had been closed at that location since before Russia's full-scale invasion, two employees who work at the club's new location told the AP. Zeluzhny believes the search warrant was a pretext and that the agency could not plausibly have mistaken the location of the country's main war command center. The 2023 counteroffensive drew widespread criticism from military experts for being too ambitious and coming too late, giving Russian forces time to fortify positions. Zeluzhny says the plan he had crafted with help from NATO partners failed because Zelensky and other officials wouldn't commit the resources it required. The original plan was to concentrate enough forces into a single fist to retake the partially occupied region of Zaporizhia, home to a vital nuclear power plant, and then have them advance south to the Sea of Azov. This would sever a corridor of land the Russian army had been using to resupply Crimea, which it illegally annexed in 2014. Success required a large concentrated buildup and tactical surprise, Zeluzhny said. What happened instead, he said, was that forces were dispersed over a wide area, diluting their striking power. His account of how the counteroffensive diverged from the original plan was corroborated by two Western defense officials who spoke on condition of anonymity because they aren't authorized to speak publicly to the media. Zeluzhny's office at the Ukrainian embassy in London reflects his years as a general. The walls are adorned with posters of military aircraft, army medals he was awarded, and children's drawings of battle scenes. There are toy drones on a mahogany table. Behind his desk, screens show real-time feeds from drones flying over the battlefield of eastern Ukraine. Zeluzhny's key criticisms of Ukraine's war strategy are that it depends on an unrealistic number of troops and is not organized well in how it develops and deploys new technologies to the battlefield. He watches developments closely, but says he has not been involved with military decision-making since Zelensky pushed him out. Zeluzhny said he and Zelensky had absolutely friendly conversations on the two occasions they met since then. Some analysts say Zeluzhny's lack of involvement in Ukraine's day-to-day political affairs could weaken his popularity. Still, an Ipsos poll published last month showed support for Zeluzhny in a hypothetical future election at 23%, compared with Zelensky's 20%, making him the president's top competitor. Many Ukrainians see him as a figure capable of changing the system, said Vladimir Fisenko, a political analyst based in Kiev. People will vote not only for Zeluzhny, but also against Zelensky, blaming him for the failures of his presidency, he explained. Zeluzhny avoids discussing politics, he says, for fear of fomenting division among Ukrainians. Until the war is over or martial law ends, I am not discussing this and have done nothing towards that, he said. Despite his reticence, a number of campaign consultants, party figures, and political insiders continue to approach Zeluzhny and offer to help craft a campaign. Zeluzhny said a fairly well-known American political consultant approached him in the spring of 2025, an official close to Zeluzhny, who spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to comment publicly, told AP it was Paul Manafort, who served as chairman of Trump's 2016 presidential campaign before he was convicted in 2018 of crimes that included secretly lobbying for Ukraine's former pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych. I thanked him for paying attention to me, but said that I did not need his services, Zeluzhny said. Manafort, who was pardoned by Trump at the end of his first term, did not respond to calls and messages from the AP. Our next article is entitled, Ukrainian and Russian envoys hold a second day of U.S. brokered talks in Geneva. This has been written by Jamie Keaton and Ilya Novikov. Envoys from Moscow and Kiev met Wednesday in Geneva for a second consecutive day of U.S. brokered talks, with officials trying to bridge political and military differences stemming from Russia's all-out invasion of Ukraine almost 4 years ago. Consultations are taking place in working groups by areas within the political and military tracks, the head of the Ukrainian delegation, Rustem Umerov, wrote in English on X. We are working on clarifying the perimeters and mechanisms of the decisions discussed yesterday. The negotiations in Switzerland are the third round of direct talks organized by the United States after meetings earlier this year in Abu Dhabi that officials described as constructive but yielded no breakthrough. U.S. President Donald Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, said on social media that Washington's push for peace in Ukraine over the past year has brought about meaningful progress. He didn't elaborate, and the fighting has continued. The two armies are locked in battle on the roughly 750-mile front line while Russia bombards civilian areas of Ukraine. Overnight, Russia launched one ballistic missile and 126 long-range drones at Ukraine, the Ukrainian Air Force said. A Russian drone strike in the southern city of Zaporizhia killed a woman and injured seven people, including two small children, according to Regional Military Administration Chief Ivan Fedorov. Russia and Ukraine appear to still be far apart on their demands for a peace settlement. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has offered a ceasefire and a face-to-face meeting with Russian leader Vladimir Putin, but Moscow wants a comprehensive agreement before committing to a truce. Putin's key goals remain what he declared when Russia invaded its neighbor on February 24th of 2022. Ukraine must renounce joining NATO, sharply reduce the size of its army, and protect Russian language and culture to keep the country in Moscow's orbit. Additionally, Putin wants Kiev to withdraw its forces from the four regions Moscow has occupied but doesn't fully control. Zelensky says Ukraine won't surrender land to Russia. Our next article is entitled, North Korea Opens a Housing District for Families of Its Soldiers Killed in Russia-Ukraine War. This has been written by King Tong Wang. North Korea said Monday it completed a new housing district in Pyongyang for families of North Korean soldiers killed while fighting alongside Russian forces in Ukraine, the latest effort by leader Kim Jong-un to honor the war dead. State media photos showed Kim Jong-un walking through the new street called Sepial Street and visiting the homes of some of the families with his increasingly prominent daughter, believed to be named Kim Ju-ai, as he pledged to repay the young martyrs who sacrificed all to their motherland. In recent months, North Korea has intensified propaganda glorifying troops deployed to fight in Russia's war against Ukraine, such as establishing a memorial wall and building a museum. Analysts see it as an effort to bolster internal unity and curb potential public discontent. Kim in recent months has sent thousands of troops and large quantities of military equipment, including artillery and missiles, to fuel Russian President Vladimir Putin's war on Ukraine as the leaders align in the face of their separate confrontations with Washington. South Korea's National Intelligence Service told lawmakers last week it estimated 6,000 North Korean troops have been killed or wounded during their deployment in the war, but did not provide a breakdown of fatalities. The agency said last year it believed roughly 600 had died. The spy agency believes North Korea forces are gaining modern combat experience and Russian technical support that could improve the performance of their weapon systems, according to lawmakers who attended last week's closed-door briefing. The construction of the new street comes as North Korea prepares to open a major ruling party congress later this month, where Kim is expected to announce his major goals in domestic and foreign policy over the next 5 years and take further steps to tighten his control. Our next article is entitled, Europeans Push Back at U.S. Over Claim They Face Civilizational Erasure. This has been written by Emma Burrows and Gare Molson. A top European Union official on Sunday rejected the notion that Europe faces civilizational erasure, pushing back at criticism of the continent by the Trump administration. EU foreign policy chief Kaja Kallas addressed the Munich Security Conference a day after U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio offered a somewhat reassuring message to European allies. He struck a less aggressive tone than Vice President J.D. Vance did in lecturing them at the same gathering last year, but maintained a firm tone on Washington's intent to reshape the transatlantic alliance and push its policy priorities. Kallas alluded to criticism in the U.S. national security strategy released in December, which asserted that economic stagnation in Europe is eclipsed by the real and more stark prospect of civilizational erasure. It suggested that Europe is being enfeebled by its immigration policies, declining birth rates, censorship of free speech and suppression of political opposition, and a loss of national identities and self-confidence. Contrary to what some may say, woke, decadent Europe is not facing civilizational erasure, Kallas told the conference. In fact, people still want to join our club, and not just fellow Europeans, she added, saying she was told when visiting Canada last year that many people there have an interest in joining the EU. Kallas rejected what she called European bashing. We are, you know, pushing humanity forward, trying to defend human rights and all this, which is actually bringing also prosperity for people. So that's why it's very hard for me to believe these accusations. In his conference speech, Rubio said that an end to the transatlantic era is neither our goal nor our wish, adding that our home may be in the Western Hemisphere, but we will always be a child of Europe. He made clear that the Trump administration is sticking to its guns on issues such as migration, trade, and climate. And European officials who addressed the gathering made clear that they in turn will stand by their values, including their approach to free speech, climate change, and free trade. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said Saturday that Europe must defend the vibrant, free, and diverse societies that we represent, showing that people who look different to each other can live peacefully together, that this isn't against the tenor of our times. Rather, it is what makes us strong, he said. Kallas said Rubio's speech sent an important message that America and Europe are and will remain intertwined. It is also clear that we don't see eye to eye on all the issues and that this will remain the case as well, but I think we can work from there, she said. And now we turn to our domestic news. This article is entitled, Strikes on Three More Alleged Drug Boats Kill 11 People, U.S. Military Says. This has been written by Ben Finley and Constantine Turpin. The U.S. military said Tuesday that it carried out strikes on three boats accused of smuggling drugs in Latin American waters, killing 11 people in one of the deadliest days of the Trump administration's months-long campaign against alleged traffickers. The series of strikes conducted Monday brought the death toll to at least 145 people since the administration began targeting those it calls narco-terrorists in small vessels since early September. Like most of the military statements on the 42 known strikes, U.S. Southern Command says it targeted alleged drug traffickers along known smuggling routes. It said two vessels carrying four people each were struck in the eastern Pacific Ocean, while a third boat with three people was hit in the Caribbean Sea. The military did not provide evidence that the vessels were ferrying drugs, but posted videos on X that show boats being destroyed. The videos posted by Southern Command show the boats either moving or bobbing in the water before the explosions engulf them in flames. People can be sitting in two of the small open vessels before they're destroyed. President Donald Trump has said the U.S. is in armed conflict with the cartels in Latin America and has justified the attacks as a necessary escalation to stem the flow of drugs. Critics have questioned the overall legality of the strikes as well as their effectiveness, in part because the fentanyl behind many fatal overdoses is typically trafficked to the U.S. over land from Mexico, where it is produced with chemicals imported from China and India. The boat strikes also drew intense criticism following the revelation that the military killed survivors of the first boat's attack with a follow-up strike. The Trump administration and many Republican lawmakers said it was legal and necessary, while Democratic lawmakers and legal experts said the killings were murder, if not a war crime. The attacks followed the Trump administration beginning one of the largest buildups of U.S. military might in Latin America in generations as part of a pressure campaign that culminated with the capture of then-Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. He was brought to the United States to face drug trafficking charges after a January 3rd raid by American forces. The world's largest aircraft carrier was ordered to the Caribbean late last year and told last week to head to the Middle East, as tensions between the United States and Iran grow. USS Gerald R. Ford and three accompanying destroyers were in the mid-Atlantic on Tuesday and no longer in the U.S. Southern Command's area of operations, according to a Navy official who spoke on condition of anonymity in order to discuss sensitive ship movements. The Ford will bolster an array of U.S. warships in the Middle East that includes the USS Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier. Since Maduro's capture, the United States military has reported several boat strikes, while American forces also have seized oil tankers connected with Venezuela as part of the Trump administration's broader efforts to take control of the South American country's oil. Republicans in Congress have defeated Democratic-led efforts to rein in Trump's ability to conduct further attacks in Venezuela. Our next article is entitled, Rescuers Pushed Through Winter Storm to Six Survivors of a California Avalanche, Nine Others Are Missing. This has been written by Olga Rodriguez and Julie Watson. Crews pushed through mountainous wilderness near Lake Tahoe during a snowstorm to rescue six backcountry skiers who survived an avalanche but were trapped by its snow and ice. Nine others from their tour group remain missing. Two of the six were taken to a hospital for treatment, said Ashley Quadros, a spokesperson for the Nevada County Sheriff's Office. The sheriff's office said Tuesday night that there were 15 skiers in the trip, not 16 as initially believed. Search and rescue crews were dispatched to Frog Lake in the Castle Peak area northwest of Lake Tahoe after a 911 call reporting an avalanche and people buried. A powerful winter storm was moving through California at the time. Extreme conditions in the Northern California mountains slowed the rescue effort. It took crews several hours to reach the skiers and take them to safety, where they were evaluated by the Truckee Fire Department. The sheriff's office said it would provide another update on rescue efforts at a news conference Wednesday morning. The skiers were on the last day of a three-day backcountry skiing trek, said Steve Renaud, a Tahoe National Forest avalanche forecaster with the Sierra Avalanche Center, which had contact with people on the ground in the area. He said the skiers spent two nights at huts on a trip that required navigating rugged mountainous terrain for up to 4 miles while bringing along all food and supplies. Nevada County Sheriff Captain Russell Green said authorities were notified about the avalanche by the ski tour company that led the expedition, Blackbird Mountain Guides, and by emergency beacons the skiers were carrying. Rescuers made their way cautiously toward the scene of the avalanche because of the danger of more avalanches. Blackbird Mountain Guide said in a statement on its website that it was coordinating with authorities on the rescue operation. California is being walloped this week by a powerful winter storm bringing treacherous thunderstorms, high winds, and heavy snows in mountain areas. It's particularly dangerous in the backcountry right now just because we're at the height of the storm, said Brandon Schwartz, Tahoe National Forest lead avalanche forecaster at the Sierra Avalanche Center based in Truckee. The center issued an avalanche warning for the area and the central Sierra Nevada, including the greater Lake Tahoe region, starting at 5 a.m. Tuesday, with large slides expected into Wednesday. The town of Soda Springs, near where the avalanche took place, recorded at least 30 inches of snow during a 24-hour period, according to the Soda Springs Mountain Resort. The dangerous conditions were caused by rapidly accumulating snow piling on fragile snowpack layers coupled with gale-force winds. The storm wreaked havoc on roads from the Sierra Nevada to Sonoma County. Traffic was halted temporarily in both directions on I-80 over and around Donner Summit due to spinouts and crashes, the authorities reported. Several Tahoe ski resorts were fully or partially closed due to the weather. Resorts along highways have avalanche mitigation programs and were not expected to be at as high of a risk as the backcountry, where travel in, near, or below avalanche terrain was strongly discouraged, the center said. Castle Peak, a 9,110-foot mountain north of Donner Summit, is a popular backcountry skiing destination. The summit, which can be perilous in snow, is named for the infamous Donner Party, a group of pioneers who resorted to cannibalism after getting trapped there in the winter of 1846 to 1847. In January, an avalanche in the region buried a snowmobiler in snow and killed him, authorities said. Each winter, 25 to 30 people die in avalanches in the United States, according to the National Avalanche Center. Training in avalanche assessment and rescue and safety equipment is highly recommended for backcountry skiing, also known as off-piste skiing, involves venturing deep into the wilderness far outside the confines of a resort. Backcountry skis are wider and heavier and have other features to handle going up and down ungroomed terrain, unlike cross-country skis, which are narrower and designed for flat, more groomed trails. Our next article is entitled, Shooter Killed Ex-Wife and a Son in Rhode Island Ice Rink Attack, police said. This has been written by Kimberly Crucy, Michael Casey, and Patrick Whittle. The person who opened fire Monday during a youth hockey game at a Rhode Island ice rink was specifically targeting family members, killing an ex-wife and son as many fans dive for cover, while a handful rushed the shooter to stop the attack, authorities said. Pawtucket Chief of Police Tina Congalves said the shooter's ex-wife, Rhonda Durgan, and adult son, Aiden Durgan, were killed, and three others were injured. Rhonda Durgan's parents, Linda and Gerald Durgan, and a family friend, Thomas Caruso, all of whom remained in critical condition Tuesday afternoon, Congalves said. Police identified the shooter as 56-year-old Robert Durgan, who died from an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound. Durgan also went by the names Roberta Esposito and Roberta Durgano, authorities said. Congalves said there was no indication there would be violence at the ice rink in Pawtucket on Monday afternoon, adding that Durgan had been to many hockey games to watch family members play before without incident. Gender identity apparently was a contributing factor to Durgan's wife filing for divorce in 2020 after nearly 30 years of marriage. Court filings show Rhonda Durgan initially wrote, gender reassignment surgery, narcissistic plus personality disorder traits as reasons for filing, but crossed that out and wrote irreconcilable differences, which have caused the irremediable breakdown of the marriage. Court documents show that two shared the same last name even prior to getting married. Authorities have not provided additional details about the same name. Under the name Roberta Durgano, Durgan posted on X that Rhonda Durgan hates the person who stole her husband while posting about the couple's marital troubles in 2018. A year later, Durgan wrote on social media, trans women, six kids, wife not thrilled, and encouraged people to not let being transgender stop them from creating a family. A day before the shooting, Durgan responded on X to an anti-transgender post by actor Kevin Sorbo and InfoWars conspiracy theorist Alec Jones by saying that constant criticism of transgender people is why we go berserk. Congalves on Tuesday credited several Good Samaritans who intervened and quickly stopped the attack. At least three bystanders were able to contain Durgan in the middle of the stands as the crowd fled and ran around them, but said Durgan was still able to reach for a second firearm and died of a self-inflicted gunshot, Congalves said. The hockey game was live-streamed by LiveBarn, a streaming platform for youth sporting events, whose videos have been shared on social media showing players on the ice as popping sounds are heard. Chaos quickly unfolds as players on benches dive for cover. Those in the ice frantically skate toward exits, and fans flee their seats. LiveBarn's social media account has been issuing warnings to those who shared the video that they do not have permission to do so. Michael Stephen, who recorded video after the shooting, recalled crying parents trying to locate their children outside the arena and young people being taken out on stretchers. It happens far too often in our nation, Stephen told reporters. Members of the community held a vigil at Slatersville Congressional Church in North Smithfield in the evening Tuesday. It's absolutely mind-boggling that this could happen to people we know and love and support through everything, said Amy Goulette, whose son is a hockey player in the community. Dorgan was an employee of General Dynamics Bath Iron Works, a shipbuilding facility in Bath, Maine, that contracts with the U.S. Navy. David Hench, a spokesperson for the shipyard, said Tuesday. Co-workers said Dorgan often used the first name Roberta at work. A colleague, Destiny McKenzie, recalled that she and Dorgan would often talk about family. McKenzie said Dorgan's ex-wife never came up in conversation, but a hockey-playing son was a frequent topic. What was supposed to be some seniors' only chance at playoff games is now ruined, she wrote in a message to the Associated Press. Images that these kids and families now have to live with. That's who I send my condolences to, is those families. McKenzie also said Dorgan had a bad temper that sometimes led to screaming matches with colleagues. Another co-worker said Dorgan appeared to be split on the issue of transgender acceptance, one second being proud of transitioning and the next embarrassed. That co-worker, who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of workplace reprisals, said they knew Dorgan owned guns but was unsure how many. Dorgan briefly served in the Marine Corps, enlisting on April 26 of 1988, according to military records provided by the service. Less than 3 months later, on July 13th, Dorgan was separated from the service with the lowest military rank. Major Jacob Getty, a Marine Corps spokesman, told the Associated Press that the rapid discharge indicated Dorgan's character was incongruent with Marine Corps expectations and standards. Getty declined to provide more detail. Monday's shooting came nearly 2 months after the state was rocked by a shooting at Brown University that killed 2 students and wounded 9 others, as well as left a Massachusetts Institute of Technology professor dead. Authorities later found Claudio Neves Valente, 48, dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound at a New Hampshire storage facility. Our next article is entitled, Minnesota's Legislature Braces for a Federal Immigration Fight as the Enforcement Surge Winds Down. This has been written by Steve Karnowski. Democrats hope to rein in the power of federal immigration officers in Minnesota as the state's legislative session gets underway Tuesday, while Republicans will focus on combating fraud and taxpayer-funded programs that President Donald Trump cited to justify the recent immigration enforcement surge. While White House Border Czar Tom Homan said over the weekend that more than 1,000 officers have left the Twin Cities area and hundreds more will depart in the days ahead, the aftermath will continue to reverberate at the state capitol during the session, which runs through May. It's unclear whether any significant changes can pass the closely divided legislature. The House is tied with a Republican speaker, while Democrats hold only a one-vote majority in the Senate, so nothing can pass without bipartisan support. And it's an election year, with all 201 legislative seats on the ballot. House Speaker Lisa DeMuth is among the GOP candidates running for governor and has expressed hope she will win Trump's endorsement. All of that could make compromise difficult. There are definitely going to be priorities on both sides of the aisle, but when it comes right down to it, we need to have bipartisan votes to move bills through the committees and get the work done for Minnesotans, DeMuth told reporters Monday. Capitol security is tighter this session following the assassination of Democratic former House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband last summer. All visitors now undergo weapons screening. Democratic Governor Tim Walz last week proposed a $10 million package of relief for small businesses that lost customers and workers during the surge, and more aid proposals could be coming. Just ahead of the session, House and Senate Democrats unveiled 11 bills to counter what they consider some of the worst excesses by federal immigration officers during the surge. They're meant to keep federal officers away from schools, childcare centers, hospitals, and colleges. They would also ban federal agents from wearing face masks while requiring them to display visible information. They would also require that federal authorities allow state investigators to participate in investigations of shootings by federal agents, such as the deaths of Renee Good and Alex Pretty. The state remains frozen out of those cases. The FBI officially notified the state Monday that it won't share information or evidence from its investigation into Preddy's death. The top House Democrat, Zach Stevenson, said they don't expect support from Republican leaders, but they're hoping some GOP lawmakers will break with their party. What we've seen these last 6 weeks has been so exceptional, so damaging, that I don't know how you can be human and not respond to it, Stevenson said. But even if it's not that, we also know it's an election year, and voters are watching, and voters will hold people accountable if they don't stand up to this administration. Stevenson also acknowledged that any restrictions the state tries to impose on federal law enforcement are likely to be challenged in court. But some things are worth fighting for, Stevenson added, and if we're not going to fight for this, what are we doing here? Republicans have expressed little enthusiasm for taking on federal authorities and hope to shift the focus to fighting fraud. Minnesotans want our state and local law enforcement to cooperate with federal immigration enforcement, said Representative Harry Niska, the number two House Republican. One of the top GOP anti-fraud priorities is legislation to create an independent Office of Inspector General to investigate and prevent the misuse of public funds. The Senate passed a similar proposal last year on a bipartisan 60-7 vote. House Democrats' leaders blocked a vote at the end of the session, but the proposal remains alive this year. Republicans also want to require more accountability for agencies and officials who let fraud happen on their watch. The final two of the nine people charged for their alleged roles in a protest that disrupted a Sunday service at a Southern Baptist church in St. Paul, where an ICE official served as a pastor, have pleaded not guilty. Minnesotan-based independent journalist Georgia Fort and Trey Hearn Cruz, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Minnesota, entered their pleas during a brief hearing before U.S. Magistrate Judge Douglas Miko. Other defendants pleading not guilty to civil rights charges at previous arraignments included former CNN host turned independent journalist Don Lemon. Ford told reporters and a crowd of supporters afterward that she was exercising her freedom of the press to cover the story of the protest at City's church on January 18th, while centering the voices of people who otherwise would not be heard. As a journalist who is from Minnesota, this case doesn't just leave me fighting for my freedom. It is a government trying to muzzle me, to make me unable to report on one of the most historic cases, not just in our state, but in our country, Ford said. Our next article is entitled, There Was a Bridge Called Jesse Jackson Across Decades of Civil Rights Advocacy. This has been written by Aaron Morrison and Sophia Tureen. From the moment the Reverend Jesse Jackson stepped forward as a torchbearer to what was then a largely Southern civil rights struggle, a movement which with much unfinished business, he created a bridge. From the South's fight with Jim Crow to the North's battle with systemic racial inequality, from the buttoned-up conservative generation of King's Circle to the dashiki-wearing Black Power leaders and the activists of the hip-hop generation, Jackson forged a link between improbable dreams and political power. From Martin Luther King to Barack Obama, there's a bridge called Jesse Jackson, the Reverend Al Sharpton said. Jackson, a protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who led the civil rights movement for decades after the revered leader's assassination, died on Tuesday, his family said. He was 84. Jackson kept up his public advocacy for racial justice, economic and political inclusion, and civil and human rights for more than a half a century, even after a neurological disorder in his later years affected his ability to move and speak. Weighing in on political events, supporting the families of Black Americans killed by police, and participating in COVID-19 vaccination drives to battle hesitancy in Black communities, Jackson built on a career that included running for president, international diplomacy, and influencing the lexicon of racial identity in America. Jackson clearly wasn't the lion he had been towards the end, but his presence at a racial justice protest and COVID-19 advocacy events and his arrest outside the U.S. Capitol while calling on Congress to end the filibuster to protect voting rights displayed the bite left in his bark. We've always had a place for him, said the Reverend William Barber II, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign and one of many activists who have followed in his footsteps. Jackson urged them to live life so that it's not your alarm clock that awakes you in the morning, but a purpose. A purpose will get you up when you want to stay down. At George Floyd's memorial service, Jackson's plaintive call, "I Can't Breathe," pierced the collective silence in a Minneapolis cathedral. He cried out twice more as the minutes ticked by to symbolize how long Floyd had a police officer's knee pressed on his neck. It was not only Jackson's powerful expression of his own grief over Floyd's death, which sparked global protest against racial injustice. It was a reminder that his voice still carried the singular resonance that for decades made him an international figure for civil and human rights. Jackson returned to rally demonstrators marching through downtown Minneapolis and stood with Floyd's family when a jury convicted former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin of murder and Floyd's death. "Even if we win," he told the marchers, "it's relief, not victory. They are still killing our people. Stop the violence, save the children, keep hope alive." I think the fact that he came and then came back for the judge's verdict, suffering with Parkinson's, shows the determination that Jesse Jackson had all the way to the end, Sharpton said in his longtime mentor. He once said to me, years before he was diagnosed with Parkinson's, "I'm not going to stop until I drop. I'm going to die in the battlefield." Early in the COVID-19 pandemic, Jackson got vaccinated and urged others to get the shot. He pointed out racial disparities in healthcare and partnered with the National Medical Association, which represents black physicians and patients, on a public health campaign to improve testing and treatment data and to recruit more African Americans to the medical field. "It's America's unfinished business. We're free but not equal," Jackson told the Associated Press in a 2020 interview. "There's a reality check that has been brought by the coronavirus that exposes the weakness and the opportunity." Jackson had his share of critics both within and outside the black community. Some considered him a grandstander, too eager to seek out the spotlight. Jackson was widely known for his appearance in photographs taken moments after King was assassinated on the balcony of Memphis Hotel on April 4th of 1968. For 2 days afterwards, Jackson wore a turtleneck he said was soaked with the venerated civil rights leader's blood, including at King Memorial Service, where he told the Chicago City Council, "I come here with a heavy heart because on my chest is the stain of blood from Dr. King's head." 2 decades later, Jackson made history with his runs for the White House. Until Barack Obama's election in 2008, Jackson was the most successful black candidate for the United States presidency, winning 13 primaries and caucuses for the Democratic nomination in 1988, 4 years after his first failed attempt. While Jackson was known for his powerful voice, his words sometimes got him in trouble. In 1984, he apologized for calling New York City Haimetown, a derogatory reference to the city's large Jewish population, and what he said he believed were private comments to a reporter. And in July of 2008, he made headlines when a hot mic caught him complaining that Obama was still talking down to black people. Still, tears streamed down his face when he joined the immense crowd in Chicago's Grand Park to celebrate Obama's 2008 election victory. "I wish for a moment that Dr. King or Medgar Evers could just have been there for 30 seconds to see the fruits of their labor," he told the AP years later. "I became overwhelmed. It was the joy and the journey." Well, that concludes our time. Until next time, and thank you for listening.